Welcome to Follow Your Curiosity, Ordinary People, Extraordinary Creativity. Here's how to get unstuck. I'm your host, creativity coach, Nancy Norbeck. Let's go. Alex Poppy decided when she was in her 20s to leave her corporate job and become an actor with no acting experience at all. After acting for 12 years, she followed her travel instincts, becoming certified to teach English overseas and moving to multiple countries, including Iraq, to pursue teaching and humanitarian work and writing. Alex is the author of four works of fiction, Duende, Jinwar and Other Stories, Moxie, and Girl World. Her writing has won numerous awards, including the International Book Award, Reader's Choice Book Award, and a 35 over 35 debut book award. Alex tells me about her decision to become an actor, how she made the move into teaching abroad, and what she's learned from both experiences, how her time abroad has influenced her writing, and more. I think you'll find this a fascinating conversation with Alex Poppy. Alex, welcome to Follow Your Curiosity.
Oh, so much. Thank you for having me, Nancy. I'm happy to be here and appreciate your giving me this opportunity to talk about my process and my work and all things creative.
Excellent. So I start everybody with the same question, which is, were you a creative kid or did you discover your creative side later on?
No, I was pretty academic and studious. I think I always had a wild imagination. I played a lot with puppets and Raggedy Ann, and it would animate just about anything that I could put my hands on, literally. But then, you know, puberty sets in, and it's such an awkward time for girls. And I grew up in the Midwest, and there was one standard of beauty, and I very ethnic looking, and, you know, my nose grew, and I felt like 10 years later, my face caught up with it. And it made me all a very conscientious reader. So was very academically inclined, and I didn't really start exploring my creativity until I had finished university and I was working my first corporate job and was bored out of my mind and was like, I'm going to be an actor, like never having been on stage or done a play or anything. And I started acting, and I went to New York and went to conservatory and was an actor for like 15 years. And then I became disillusioned with it and I started writing. So I started writing. I took my first class in 2010. And so the storytelling's always been there. I think it got sidelined when I was, you know, awkward and adolescent and unsure of myself.
How did people react when you said, I'm out of this corporate gig, I'm going to go be an actor?
I can remember that. My parents, I think, thought it was like the dumbest move ever and were not excited about it. It was so funny. I worked for Mobil Oil Corporation. It was the late 80s, early 90s, and it was the beginning of that corporate downsizing. Mm. And I had only been employed with them like a little more than a year or so. And I opted to downsize. I don't know where I had the audacity to do that. But they gave it to me. And so I had already started acting, was taking classes at the Walnut Street Theater in Philly and doing theater in Philly, and downsized, and then got a job with a touring company. And we went out during the week, we went to schools and did shows on self-esteem, good touch versus bad touch, physical abuse, and living with a substance abuse parent. And the idea was that you played these characters that kids could relate to. They would disclose the characters and you could hook them up with someone in their immediate environment so they could have ongoing treatment. And then I was doing mystery theater on the weekends so I could support myself. And I was so green as an actor. I was like, oh, this is easy, you know, to make a living. I think it was like the first and last time. But so people were not excited, but I mean, I had a great time. And then when I moved to New York and went to Circle in the Square Theater Conservatory, was also, Circle is a weird place, or was at the time, but my friends from that part of my life and on are lifelong friends. And I feel like the things that I've learned in acting conservatory have served me throughout my life. Like I can tell when someone's being dishonest because they usually have a vocal tell. They usually devoice. Mm. They go up in here when they talk. And you know that either they're not being truthful or you're making them uncomfortable in some way. So you can adjust. There's like a lot of emotional intelligence was heightened, and the powers of observation were really, really heightened for me and trained, because you're focused so much in conservatory training, watching the other people. And so that served me really well as a teacher. I was a teacher for like 16 years, and I could quite quickly identify where a student was having their learning hurdle and then give them individualized attention because of those observation skills developed in conservatory training. But that also serves me as a writer, like just the empathy that you need for characters when you're an actor or when you're trying to help someone who's struggling to learn something very much translates into how I write. I write from an acting kind of process way, finding the emotional connection to the material and living within the given circumstance and then the assumed circumstance, like you finding the emotional truth of what I'm writing so I can connect to character and then write from that place. All that, I think, comes from actor training. And then, you know, giving the character a place to sit in a scene definitely comes from working with a camera and understanding how the story is being told and how the camera shot is influencing what part of the story that, you know, as a writer, you're very much directing the reader, much like the camera directs the reader. So all of it has informed, I think, everything that I do.
I think it's so fascinating that, you know, you can point to such specific places where all of these skills have been useful to you somewhere else, considering that so many people are just like, oh, they just pretend for a living. Actors don't really know how to do anything. It's like, that's not true at all.
No, and they're often like such well-read people, you know, because you're curious, you do research, much like writing. No, for me, it was a great time in my life. And when I was ready to leave it, I didn't have any regrets about leaving it. You have to love it. It's difficult. So I didn't love it anymore. And I really desperately wanted to live outside my culture, which I then proceeded to do for about 16 years, which was phenomenal. I would never give up that part of my life. I miss it a lot. I mean, I came back deliberately because I wanted to put roots down in a place, and Iraq, you know, wasn't the place for me to drop anchor, but
imagine why not.
But I do miss it. I do miss it. I miss feeling useful. I mean, I work in humanitarian aid and peace building, but because I'm not in the field, I actually don't feel useful most of the time.
So how did you end up finding the opportunity to go spend time abroad? Because that can be difficult for a lot of people to do.
You know, I read, so one of the last acting jobs I did was this 30-minute film written and directed by a woman named Larissa Kondracki, who went on to do The Whistleblower, where she directed from her own screenplay Vanessa Redgrave and Rachel Weisz and David Strathairn. I mean, like this stellar cast, right? So I was doing her film, this 30-minute film, and she was like, hey, can you read my script and tell me, you know, what you think? And I was fascinated. And so I started to read all her source material. And in particular, there was a book by a Canadian journalist called Victor Marlek. The book is The Natashas. And there was a chapter about this woman, Catherine. I'm sorry, Catherine, I'm going to say your last name wrong. Volkovac. She was from the Midwest. And she went and was a police officer and signed up to be a peacekeeper in Bosnia right at the Balkans War, and ended up seeing like the UN complicity in trafficking, and was a whistleblower with a lot of peril and bad effects to herself trying to do the right thing. She's a real hero. You know, look her up. And that put me down this rabbit hole of reading. And then around that time, I read Emergency Sex and Other Desperate Measures, 10 Years of Deployment by UN aid workers. And then that book really did change my life. Then I used to go to this thing called Naked Angels Tuesdays at 9. They do one in New York. I think they do one in Chicago, maybe. And actors go to cold read so writers can hear the words out loud. And you have like no one's like me. But you also are in a room with Kenny Lonergan and, you know, J. Cameron Smith. And so it's just great, you know? And there was a guy there who wanted to be a director, and his fiance was best friends with Kofi Annan's press secretary's fiance. And so this guy said, do you want to talk to Nick? Because I was like, oh, how do I get abroad? You know, I want to get into humanitarian aid. So I talked to Nick. And when Nick was like, well, how do you go from wanting to be an actor to wanting to do humanitarian aid? I explained to him, you know, how emergency sex and other desperate measures had really had a profound effect. And he's like, do you want to meet one of the authors? Because Nick had been, he knew all those guys from UN deployments. And he was like thanked in the thank yous at the end of the book. And so the New Zealand writer, Andrew, was in town and I got to meet him. So it was like my Alice through the looking glass moment. I felt like I'd gone down the rabbit hole. It was one of the best experiences. And he was staying in Ken's apartment. So I'm in Ken's apartment. Andrew and I were having a beer. We had seen a film. We were talking. And then there's Andrew's bookcase. And on the bookcase are all these pictures, like personal photos, but they're all, these photos are in this book. And I've read this book a bazillion times. I know it backwards and forwards. And so I'm standing in front of these photos that I've only seen reproduced in my favorite book. And I, all of a sudden, like, it became something that was tangible, and it moved from dream to possibility. Mm-hmm. So I certified to teach. Nick had said, you can either go to grad school and get a master's in IR, which I was pretty old at that point, and I didn't really want to incur that kind of debt. He said, you can apply for one of the UN agencies, but I mean, my background was acting in business, and that's not going to happen. He's like, or you could go abroad to a conflict zone and find out where the aid folks drink, go befriend them, volunteer, and get in that way. And I was like, I'm not that brave. So I certified to teach English as a second language. And then English as a foreign language. And I went abroad and started to volunteer. And so that's what happened. Then I came back to the US and was here for like a year and change and kind of lost. And I met the writer, Jerry Van Dyke, who at that time was CBS's like guru on anything and all things Afghanistan, Pakistan. And Jerry had written a book called Captive. He had been kidnapped by the Taliban and held for 45 days. And he was the second journalist to be kidnapped after Daniel Pearl. Boy. And I met him at his, he is my hero. He's become a mentor. He's so generous. He's so generous of spirit and knowledge and kindness and support. Oh, great, great human. I met him at the book signing and we became friends, and he really encouraged me to go to Iraq. I saw a job posting at an international high school. And so I went in 2011, when I think most of us didn't know where Kurdistan was. Maybe thought it was one of those stands over there, meaning near Russia and not actually in northern Iraq. But I think with the Yazidi genocide and ISIS, obviously people know where Kurdistan is now, but in 2011, I think most people hadn't heard about it. I certainly was so green. Mm-hmm. You know, I got an Arabic for Dummies book and they speak Kurdish in Kurdistan, not Arabic. You know what I mean? So I was definitely flying blind. I think I managed to get a few vaccines, and that was probably the entirety of my prep.
Wow. Wow. So what happened once you got there?
Oh, it was great. I mean, it wasn't at all what I, you know, Jerry thought it was going to be rougher than it was. But at that point, Northern Iraq Kurdish region was really prospering. It was the only safe place. Oil and gas exploration were through the roof. So you had tons of contractors and expats. It was fun. And I just fell in love with the students there. I mean, I think students are great everywhere. I am that geek that'll like go on holiday and talk about my students because I miss them. And I had taught at in several contexts before that point, but there's just a real sweetness in that region. And I think students are great everywhere. I have very close ties to the students I taught in Ukraine and Turkey and Germany. But there's a sweetness in the Middle East that, you know, it can break your heart. It really was so, it was such a gratifying experience. I feel like the students were so warm, and it's the kind of thing where that was over a decade ago, and I'll still have students hit me on social media to say, I miss you, or I saw that photo. And, well, you know, one of the reasons I came back from Iraq was both my parents got COVID and my father didn't make it. Oh, and sorry. Thank you. I had students just all over the world were praying for him in all these different languages and religions. And I had this one student, I swear that kid must have messaged me on Facebook almost every day just to see how he was doing while he was in hospital and then when he passed. I mean, it's an exceptional kindness. I'm so lucky that I got to teach over there. And so I was there for 2 years. And in the summer, I went to the West Bank and did an education project for the State Department working with Palestinian at-risk youths. So this current conflict really cuts, I mean, as it does for so many people. But those kids were amazing too. And so it'd be years later and I would get a random message. I can remember I was in Spain on a term break and President Trump had just announced the Muslim ban. And all these students started to reach out on social media to see if I was okay. Would I be able to get back in to any country? And they were worried. They're worried for me, you know, all the privilege of my American passport. And they're worried for me.
Yeah.
And this one kid was one of my Palestinian kids and he had become a teacher. And, you know, he's like, it's just so sweet. Right. Then I went to Germany for 2 years. Because I had fallen in love with a German. And then I went back to Iraq when I think I was leaving that relationship in pieces. And so I went back to a different city in Iraq. And so I was in Erbil for the first 2 years, and then I was in Sulaymaniyah for six. And that was great too, because I did my master's when I was in Germany, which meant I had a better job at a university. And that university was such an intellectual hub. It had the Suli Forum. It was founded by the president of Iraq, Dr. Barham Saleh. So you know, it was a lot of work and a lot of monotony and boring, but every once in a while something phenomenal would happen and you got to do something that you were like, I cannot believe I'm here, you know? Like I had been mugged when I was in Spain. I was mugged in Italy. I was robbed in Spain. When I was trying to fly home for my mom's 80th birthday. And so my passport was taken, which had my Kurdish visa in it. And we also had special visas at that time. You needed them to go into Baghdad and they were super difficult to get. And so when I had come back into the country, which necessitated a bunch of like WASTA and fixers, you know, calling airlines, it's so funny. So they needed a teacher to come down. A crew from the university were going to train teachers for the Ministry of Higher Education for this learning center. And so I didn't have my visa anymore. And our head of security literally walked me across like passport control, the border between Kurdistan and Iraq, because his cousin, I think, had taken a bullet for Dr. Barham. And this guy was like golden. He had WASTA. So he walked me across and they basically hand wrote a visa in my passport.
Wow.
Yeah, I have this passport here. So funny. So stuff like that would happen, right? And you're just like, whoa. But a lot of the times it was just like, you know, a lot of work. And then other times, I mean, they just, the students would break your heart. Like, we had lots of Yazidi students, you know, and that was still, ISIS was raging through Mosul. When President Trump withdrew the U.S. troops from northern Syria and kind of gave Turkey the carte blanche to go in and do what it wanted to the Syrian Kurds, our school opened up all these scholarships so we could take a bunch of Syrian Kurdish students and give them a place to live and keep them safe. And, you know, there's, you know, we think university life is hard and they're negotiating it with all these other realities that we only know from, yeah, you know, news feeds or badly written films, you know, or there, it's such a dichotomy. I had this student so close to him, and he, like, he was telling me this story about when during the U.S. invasion, he lived in Anbar province. And sometimes the soldiers would come in for a house raid, and they were very polite. They would take off their gloves and they would shake his father's hand, and his father spoke English. And other times they threw all the men in the courtyard and beat them, including my student who was like 12 at the time. And so they're war weary. I mean, he remembers during the, I guess it must have been the 2007 to 2009, very violent time in the Anbar province, like US Humvees rolling up the streets, insurrectionists fighting against them, teachers like trying to get the students out of the way, and like a Jeep would blow up, and the next day they would, you know, find body parts, or like what they did for fun was like connect or take, find, collect the bullets on the street and like collect the gunpowder and light it up. So it's like, it's a very drastic reality for a 12 or 13 year old. And then as an adult in his early 20s, he's like, so Alex, like, how do I ask her out? Like, well, why don't you invite her for coffee? You know, so it's that kind of, they're like so innocent in some way. And then they've seen these complete atrocities in another. And that's what I mean. Like, they really, for me, they broke my heart, and not in a bad way, in a good way. You know, I learned a lot.
Yeah.
I learned a lot.
Yeah. I mean, you couldn't not. There's,
I just,
no,
I miss
way.
Them.
Oh,
I miss them.
I don't doubt it for a second. I used to teach. I still miss my kids.
And oh, you know,
like 15 years. So yeah. Yeah.
What grade did you teach?
I had middle and high school kids, and I mostly, I taught for 8 years, and the last six of it, I was teaching ESL, but I was here in New Jersey and they were coming here from, at that point, mostly Korea and Taiwan, with the occasional from Thailand, Poland, Germany, you know, some completely random place that was not Korea or Taiwan, but, Russia, a couple Russian kids. And yeah. And I know what you mean when you say that they broke your heart. Because especially like the really little ones, you know, when they came over in seventh grade and they're like 12 years old and mom and dad are dropping them off and then they're going to go get on a plane and fly home. And here's this adorable little kid in a completely different country, different language that they, you know, speak enough to function, but maybe not terribly comfortably. And they're just kind of looking around like, oh God, now what? You know, and it would take about a month before the novelty would wear off and it would really hit them. It's like, I haven't seen mom and dad in a month. And, you know, the world is crumbling because I don't know what's going on now, because this is not just exciting and different anymore. This is like, where the hell are my parents?
Yeah. 100%.
All sorts of interesting things, but not as interesting as what you saw. You know,
no, I mean, It's all interesting in its own ways.
Oh yeah.
I mean, the quotidian is interesting. I mean, writers make their career on the quotidian. I can understand that right when I was leaving the university, the US had withdrawn from Afghanistan, and so AUIS took a bunch of of female students and some of their teachers and welcome them at the university. And I can remember like seeing the students, they're just kind of shell-shocked, you know, they don't know if they'll ever go back or be able to see their families or when, and they're in this new environment. Yeah. My heart, I really feel for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a level of turmoil that most of us can't relate to at all.
No, but you saw it with your kids. Mm-hmm. I'm sure some of them, you know, it's like, it's such a new and different place.
Yeah.
Everything is different. Yeah.
It was really a question of when is the homesickness going to hit you? Is it going to be the minute mom and dad walk out the door, or is it going to take a couple of weeks? And even kids who, you know, we had kids who would come from 7th grade to 12th every year. And even when they had done it before and they already had friends to come back to and whatever, it's still things, you know, middle of October, things would always get a little wonky. And, you know, and then everybody would kind of settle back in and, oh, yeah, here we are. But yeah, I mean, we had all sorts of things that, you know, like rivalries between the Korean kids and the Taiwanese kids. And there were two girls in particular, one Korean girl and one Taiwanese girl, who were just absolutely best buds. And I can't remember which group it was, you know, said to the girl from their country, like, what are you doing spending all your time with her? You should be hanging out with us because she's, you know, Korean or Taiwanese, whichever one it was, and we're not. And so she felt all of this social pressure to kind of back away from that friendship. And it was like, really? But you guys were such good friends. And I think that they did eventually come back together, but it was just kind of like, this is where you see that, you know, artificial divisions and things are just so stupid. Like, everybody's here. We're all going to the same school. You're in the same classes. Why do you have to make a big deal out of it? You know, it's like, you really don't. You know, it's all okay. She's still just as Korean as she was before she walked in the school, just because she has a friend from Taiwan, or maybe the opposite, since I don't remember which way it went. But, you know, whereas like the single kid from Poland was just kind of like, whatever, you know, nobody to run around speaking Polish with, just have to find a way to get along with everybody, because you can't just kind of form that instant click based on nationality. So yeah, it was a really interesting thing to watch all of the different dynamics and how they played out. And I learned in a hurry too, with the Asian kids, that you had to choose your moment for the email home. If there was an issue with a kid, like, I would go to great lengths to avoid sending the email home, because it was an incredibly powerful thing, to the point where you thought, exactly what happened between my email and this kid suddenly, you know, behaving himself in class or doing more effort on his homework or whatever. What exactly happened to make that change happen? Because I'm a little scared. And so it was like, look, I don't want to have to email mom and dad. So how about you work with me? Because we'll both be happier. But yeah, because I think with some of them, there were some very harsh conversations. It was just like, I don't want to do that to you. You know? But yeah, I mean, I saw amazing things. I saw kids, you know, who came in like total goofballs and have ended up doing fabulous things out in the real world once they got past the goofball stage, you know, kids that you thought were never going to get anywhere. And I'm sure you know exactly what I'm talking about, because kids are kids. But yeah, it's like, you're going to break my heart before the end of the year. I just know you're going to break my heart before the end of the year, you know. And then maybe they did, maybe they didn't. But one way or another, 15 years later, they're all doing fabulous things. So, you know,
that's great.
That I know of. I still hear from a bunch of them, just like you do. So, yeah, it's such a cool thing.
Do you write about them? I mean, I don't mean literally, but I mean, do they influence your writing? Do you write in that voice? Do you write about, are your characters that age? And does it influence your artistic life?
That's such an interesting question, because I've never thought about it consciously, but I'm sure that they do. I was doing my MFA my last 2 years in that job, and to my great surprise, ended up writing a young adult fantasy novel. I have no idea to what extent that came out of the fact that I was teaching that age level.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I can't think of anything in particular, but there are definitely experiences in teaching them writing that probably made an impression one way or another that I'm not necessarily even aware of, you know, like you would phrase this differently than I would because you don't know the idiom and yet I like your version too. So, you know, stuff like that where I was like, I kind of don't want to correct this because it's not standard English, but I really like the way that it works.
Yeah.
So I have to tell you that it's not standard English, but if you don't want to change it, I'm okay with that. So yeah, that's a really interesting question. I'll have to think about that one.
My kids are all over my first collection and my third one too, I think, yeah. In a way.
Sure. Well, I wanted to ask you how spending time in all of these different places has influenced your creativity, because I'm sure it must have. I always think that traveling is a fabulously creative experience, whether you realize it or not.
My writing's always really anchored in place. So in that sense, traveling, yes. I mean, my latest book is set half in Detroit. Actually, I've never been there, and half in Seville. Where I spent a lot of time because I get interested in something and I'm like a dog with a bone. Like it's there and I can't let go. So I visited Seville and just fell in love with the city and came back. And so I use flamenco a little bit in my second book. And then in my fourth book, it's a coming of age novella where flamenco is the metaphor for coming of age. Mm. So I was back and forth a lot then from Iraq. And I had a couple of art residencies in Spain and would always spend a significant amount of time, you know, depending on my teaching schedule there. A lot of my first collection and my third collection takes place in the Middle East. So obviously influenced by things that I've experienced and or read about. A lot of my work is social justice issues theme it or in the background, a lot of gender. So it's basically what's occupying my conscious mind.
Mm-hmm.
But it's sometimes like the littlest thing. Like I had a friend who told me that there was this bar across the street from the university and he was shocked. He'd gone in. He was a Greek expat and he had gone in with some Kurdish man that he was friends with. And it was like a brothel with like these women dancing. And what shocked him about it was the women had lays of money around their necks. And the Kurdish dinar, the Iraqi dinar is different color. So you could tell how much a woman cost.
Ooh.
And he was shocked because some of the girls were really young, like the age of his daughter, like 12, 13. Mm-hmm. So that's what he found shocking. So he told me that offhandedly about this experience going, and that's basically all I had from him. He didn't really go into any other detail. And it just stuck with me, and I always knew I would write to that. I didn't know which story it would come out, but I always knew I would write to that moment. And then I did in my third book, in my third collection. So little things like that would influence it, my writing. I was really fascinated the first 2 years in Iraq about how, you know, high school is such a hard time for girls because your body's going through all these changes and it's being hijacked by hormones and your face mm-hmm. is exploding in acne and you just feel so awkward. So I felt like, how do my students who had been raised in Western countries, they were part of the Kurdish diaspora who then came back when Kurdistan was safe. Like, how do they manage suddenly this curtailing of their freedoms on top of being in high school?
Right.
And so that influenced, you know, that theme pops up a lot in my first collection. Because I was in love with my students. Like they fascinated me in a way that just made me really happy. They're so funny. They're all getting married now. They're all adults. It's like, like, wow, it's amazing you're an adult and yet I'm the same though.
Yeah, because they stay kids in your head forever. And then, at least for me, and then when you see them, you're like, wait, you're actually how old?
Yeah, 100%.
That's not okay.
100%.
Yeah. Yeah, one of mine came back to visit a couple of years ago and said that he was like 30-something. I'm like, no, you're not. No, you're 18. You'll forever be 18. He's like, no, I'm not. I'm like, yes, you are. Yeah, it's wild. I kind of want to ask you how they do adapt to all of that, but that's probably a whole other conversation.
I mean, I don't know. I guess maybe they had probably fairly conservative households, but I think in some cases, like I can remember for a couple of female students who were really bright and they just, they weren't going to be allowed to go to university abroad because of cultural dictates. And like, there were some students, like they could go to university abroad if like a brother or a cousin got in and the girl was like, smarter than the boy and the boy didn't get in. So then the girl couldn't go. That kind of stuff drove me bananas.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm a guest in the culture. So there was some of that though, which is heartbreaking. Or they, you know, they have these dreams and they have these aspirations, but cultural dictates tell them to like put that on a shelf. It's not going to happen for you. So it was kind of strange.
Yeah, that's got to be very hard to watch.
Yeah. Try to have like little pockets of subversion.
Yeah. That's totally how I would be in that situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just find some little thing, even if it's tiny, just be like, come here, let's do this. Yeah. So when did you start seriously writing? Was it while you were abroad or was it something that kind of, you know, started halfway there or later on?
I started in 2010 when I was back in the States. I had worked in Poland, Turkey, and Ukraine at that point. And came back to New York in 2010 and had a really terrible job and no health insurance and was back waiting tables a couple nights a week in an unglamorous restaurant where I think everyone there thought I was an undercover ICE agent because I didn't understand someone my age, like working at this, mm-hmm. you know, very mediocre place. And I took a writing class at the writers, the Writer's Studio in New York. I can't believe I just blanked on their name because I really think everything I know about writing, I learned from them and not from my masters. The Writer's Studio in New York is a phenomenal place to study. I would definitely recommend it to anyone. And then when I went and took the job in Iraq, I did classes online and I would get online at like 3 in the morning. But
wow.
to go to class, which was great. Yeah, no, it was good. So yeah, I think I started in 2010 in the fall. And by the fall of 2011, I was in Iraq. So it was good. And then working at the international high school, because they give you accommodation to live in, I saved enough money. And then I went to grad school and I didn't have to take a loan. And then I kept writing. My thesis was half of my first collection. Mm-hmm. And then I just kept writing. I didn't take any more classes when I got to the university. It was a very robust work schedule. I mean, if you want to teach well, it takes a lot of time.
Right.
And I just kept writing. And then the first book was acquired and the publisher sat on it for 2 years and then finally released it, which was a bit annoying because, you know, I have a story about why girls join jihad that I finished in like 2013. And at that point, nobody was really writing about it yet. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, by 17, it was old news. And then my next book came out in 19 and then the two books came out in 22. One was supposed to come out before, but it was delayed by COVID. So there you have it. I don't write as much right now. I think because I write so much for my day job that it's really hard to want to sit down at a desk. to write at night, whereas teaching, I was a pretty physical teacher. So it was kind of nice to sit down every day.
Yeah. So do you kind of see your writing as an extension of the humanitarian work? Do they dovetail at all?
Oh, for sure. 100%. At least the geopolitical context of where I work, I tried to get away from social justice themes in the flamenco novella, but there are a few. That book started with this idea. I was listening to an interview with a writer, and her partner had come out of incarceration and how hard it was for him to get his life started, because we don't do much to support people who come out, especially when they've been in for nonviolent crimes. So that was in my mind. Urban Blight was in my mind, and I think that's why it's set in Detroit. And then, you know, flamenco really takes over as this, like I said, the central metaphor for coming of age. But it's very steeped in Sevilla. It's very steeped in place because I love that city. And the Gitano culture, which I found really fascinating because it's so communal in a way that Muslim cultures are, which I actually don't find American culture to be. We're much more individualistic. So I liked kind of being in that lived reality of the fiction I was writing. So that's the closest, that's the book that's gotten the farthest away from social justice issues, but there is a little bit there.
Yeah.
That book is really lyrical. That book took a long time to write because it's really lyrical. And sometimes I'm asked to do a reading and I go back and I read, I'm like, how did I ever write this? Because I'm my mind is so not in that mind space. And I can't believe it was in that mind space for so long, because the book is just like, it's kind of dense. You thank God it's a novella, but it's so lyrical. It's really about language. And so if you don't like language, you probably wouldn't like it.
It's interesting though, how it is kind of like this little time capsule of where your head was at a certain time. When you go back and look at things like that, they're sort of this moment of you frozen in amber when you check out your old work.
That's a lovely image.
Yeah.
Frozen in amber. Are you a writer?
Wow. So I was going to ask what you're working on these days, but you just mentioned that it's harder to write now. So I don't know how much.
I am.
Okay.
I have a memoir and essay about this time in Iraq that I started at the Atlantic Center for the Arts. I went down there in 2020 for a writer residency, and I had brought some fiction down that was eviscerated in workshop. Rightly so, I might add. Rightly so. And we were sitting around at dinner, and the master artist was like, why aren't you writing these stories? And I said, you know, I tried once in grad school and I failed miserably. And he really encouraged me to write it. And so I wrote about the death of a really good friend of mine in Iraq in 2019. And then I finally finished the memoir the end of last year. And I had some really generous rejection letters from some publishers. Well, I don't feel like they need to actually tell you why they're rejecting it in a very specific, concrete, individual way. And so three of them did, and they were all kind of talking about the same thing. So I've taken it back to rewrite it, but then a press offered to take it, and I actually said no to them because I do want to do these rewrites just for the learning aspect of it, because I'm the kind of writer that I start over every day. And obviously when you're into a novel, like, that's impossible, but I'll do a sections. So I start over and I'm constantly rewriting. So when I'm done, it's pretty much done. Tortoise books. Jerry, the person who runs that, owns that press, he's a great editor. And we did line by line edits for Moxie, my second book, Jerry Brennan, and he was great. But that's the only publisher I've had that really gave any kind of intentionality to edits or gave edits at all. Publisher one and publisher three didn't at all. Not even for typos. I mean, like,
wow,
at all. Right. So, but Jerry was great. And he, I mean, we would sometimes argue about punctuation. So it was, that was great, but I have never had to do like a big rewrite. So it's hard. I don't know how to do it. So I'm glad I'm doing it just for the sake of doing it, to learn about that. Mm-hmm. Because maybe it's time to consider a different way of working. Like, I was on a panel with Kate Weisel and, I'm blanking on his name, and he's a really good author and he won a lot of awards and he's on Tortoise Books imprint. And I can't believe I'm blanking on his name, but I am. We were talking about the way we write. And, you know, I do a craft preamble that I learned how to do at Writer's Studio. And they looked at me like I was a Martian with 5 million heads. Like, they're like, you do what? So our like the way our processes were really different. So doing these edits is a good learning experience, I think.
Sure. I have to ask, what is a craft preamble? Because I have never heard of this before either.
So it's from the Writer's Studio. Again, I cannot say enough good things about the Writer's Studio. You're kind of setting out, it's for an exercise. And like these exercises might morph into short stories or something longer, but it's really just to try on a technique. So ideally, you close read something and you analyze it to say, like, why is it working? Why am I so compelled to keep reading this? And you isolate what you think the craft technique is. And then you're going to try that technique on with your own material. So I might, in my preamble, define, is it first or third? Is my persona narrator the person I, the writer, craft to tell the story? Even if it's an I, it's not me, I, it's a fictional I. So what are their characteristics? What's their personality like? What's their tone like? What's the mood of the piece, the emotion fueling it? So the craft preamble might like start out like that. So maybe I'm a mobile third person narrator, or I'm first person and I'm like, you know, a jazzy kind of tone, very conversational. Maybe it's erudite. Maybe it's lyrical, you know, maybe it's a close third, maybe it's not, you know, you're setting out what you want to try on. And then you write a few pages and then you go back and you say, okay, where did I keep to my technique and where did it falter? Where does it need to be strengthened? Where did I lose the thread? And sometimes you lose the thread and you actually get something really good. Mm-hmm. It's just like a way to get started.
That's so interesting, because like part of the way through that description, I was thinking, oh, this sounds like the annotations that we had to do at Goddard. And then the longer you talked, the more I was like, no, like in spirit, maybe, but in execution, not at all. So
you're trying to get the voice of the persona narrator, because the persona narrator, the mood and the tone really drive the narrative piece. And so when the voice is strong, when I feel like I can hear the narrator, then I don't need to put the preamble at the top of my page anymore. Then it will disappear from the manuscript.
That is so wild. Yeah, we had to read a certain number of books and then write like 3 pages on one technique from that book and how it worked and why, which is the similarity that I was hearing. But we weren't required to go out and imitate it, though. The idea was that what you were getting out of those books was going to inform what you write. Like, there was a reason you picked that book. So in that respect, you weren't necessarily doing it consciously, but you were using all of that stuff. But that sounds way more detailed and intentional in terms of getting yourself started and creating something from it, which is really cool.
It's not long. It's like a couple, you know, it's as much as you want it to be. Do you want to start media raw? Like, it's whatever you want it to be. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely, for me, if I can't hear the narrator, I have a really hard time. And I'd had so many like brash, mouthy narrators. Gee, I wonder why. And then Duende, the novella, was so lyrical, and that narrator wasn't. I mean, that book had many crap iterations before I finally found what it was. And I mean, like 50, 60 pages into, I mean, it really started out, I thought maybe I would write something dystopian. And then I chucked that, and then I was in the Detroit part, and it was crap. And I don't know how I found my way into what it eventually became. But then when I did, it was there. Mm-hmm. And but it was slow going because it was so lyrical.
Yeah, it's amazing how things don't work until you finally hit the one little switch that, you know, oh, this is what it is, or this is how I need to set it up, or that's the piece of the character that wasn't working and now I know what to do with it. And then it's like the world goes from black and white to color, and you can, you know what you're doing, even if, as you say, it takes a little longer. It's like, ah, I get it now. It's kind of a magical moment.
Yeah, I like those serendipitous moments where everything in your life seems to fit for what you're writing. I mean, maybe it doesn't and you don't realize it. But when it does, you're like, or something you wrote like on page 30 suddenly makes sense on page 8, like 180, and you're like, oh.
Yeah.
Because I don't actually plot mine out. Like, I write beat by beat. Mm-hmm. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not a person who makes an outline. They're like, what happens next? I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah,
I have to wait till the character tells me. It's very much that.
Yeah, I may know, like, I have to get to this particular point, but not know anything else. Like, I know this part has to happen, but I don't know how I'm getting there, and I don't know what happens after that. And sometimes I don't even know that much. It's like,
yeah,
just what you say. It's like, I don't know. I'm going wherever they take me, and then we'll see what makes sense when I'm done, and go back and fix what needs to be fixed to make it all look like I knew what I was doing the whole time.
Right.
Yeah. But that part is fun too. That part's like
for sure
a puzzle. Yeah. But there's an energy. I mean, it blows my mind. There are so many people, you know, I've seen on online forums who will insist that it's not possible to write a book that way. And I'm like, well, I did it and I'm not the only one. So, you know, it definitely is possible. And it's weird because I would never say to somebody who outlines, oh, it's impossible to write a book from an outline. You know, but they'll be like, you can't write a book if you don't know where you're going. It's like, well, yes, you can. I just don't work the same way that you do. And it's okay. You know, your way's fine. My way's fine. It's all good.
Yep. 100%.
But I think there's an energy that comes from not knowing where you're going and being curious to see what happens next that is hard to replicate any other way. It's probably not impossible because people who plot ahead of time certainly are capable of writing really, really good books that are very compelling. But I think that the energy that's in you as you're writing it comes out on the page because you're trying to figure it out at the same time too, as the reader is. So that's my little mini treatise on pantsing versus plotting.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Do you write one thing at a time, or are you a kind of writer that's working on multiple projects at the same time?
I write like one fiction thing at a time, but I may work on other things at the same time. Like right now I have a Substack newsletter that I started a couple months ago as kind of an experiment. So there I'll write whatever is on my mind that week, or sometimes, you know, something that I've been toying with for several weeks, you know, here and there. But with fiction, it's really pretty much one thing at a time. How about you?
Me too. Yeah, no, I'm like one project at a time. Besides when I'm, you know, right for work and stuff.
I think when you get to that point where your characters start talking to you, they'd get jealous if you start talking to somebody else.
That's hilarious.
Because I don't know about you, but that's like where I always feel like, oh, now it's working. Because now my characters are talking to me, like while I'm driving the car to the grocery store.
Yes.
They're talking to me. And like, okay, you want to wait till I'm in front of the keyboard and can do something with this? Because that'd be great. You know? When they start to have a life of their own, then I think you know you've hit something.
Yeah. I was working on my first collection and this narrator kept barging into my head. And I was, you know, I was in a story and I was like, you know, batted her away. And like, had a great first line. She was like, I think I could kill someone if I had to.
Ooh.
And so batted her away. And then I was scrolling through Facebook and I saw a picture of one of my favorite people in the world, a really good friend of mine named John Fico, fabulous actor in New York. Hi, John. And he had posted this picture of him when he must've been 17, 18. And I was like, oh my God. And then the female voice of, I think I could kill someone, came back in my head and I started just writing in a spiral. And that became this book really about friendship. It was also about genetically modified embryos, but it's a short story. But it really came from that voice was kind of already bothering me. Mm-hmm. And then seeing this picture of John, and I was like, I need to write to the energy in this photo and have like a celebration of friendship. And that's what the whole catalyst of that story was.
Yeah. Those moments are amazing. And I think if you ignore them, you really lose out on something because there's always something special that comes from them.
100%.
You know, it's the kind of thing you couldn't make happen. So when it does, you should grab it and run with it. So I'm glad you did.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Me too. That was a good story. It's a fun story. Well, thank you so much, Nancy. I can't believe the hour just went by. It was fast.
It's very quick. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. This has been really, really cool. That's this week's episode. Thanks so much to Alex Poppy for joining me and to you for listening. Please leave a review for this episode. There is a link right in your podcast app. And in it, tell us about a time when you took a risk. If you enjoyed our conversation, I hope you'll share it with a friend. Thank you so much. If this episode resonated with you, or if you're feeling a little bit less than confident in your creative process right now, join me at The Spark on Substack as we form a community that supports and celebrates each other's creative courage. It's free, and it's also where I'll be adding programs for subscribers and listeners. The link is in your podcast app, so sign up today. See you there, and see you next week. Follow Your Curiosity is produced by me, Nancy Norbeck, with music by Joseph McDade. If you like Follow Your Curiosity, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to tell your friends. It really helps me reach new listeners.